Imagine a piece of highly advanced, like multi-million dollar software telling you that a physical reaction requires a space smaller than a single atom to take place.
Right, you'd instantly think the software was broken.
Yeah. Or at least that, you know, someone forgot to carry a decimal point or something. But well, today we are doing a deep dive into how an entire global industry decided to trust the software instead of the fundamental laws of physics.
It is honestly a remarkable case study in scientific blind spots. I mean, when we build trillion-dollar industries on top of foundational math, we desperately want that math to be an unshakable bedrock.
But sometimes that bedrock turns out to be a complete illusion. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring a massive scientific mystery today, pulling from a really incredible stack of sources.
Yes, yeah, specifically a series of fascinating lectures by material science expert HKDH Padatia, alongside his 2016 paper published in the journal Current Opinion in Solid State and Material Science.
Right. And our mission today is to figure out how exactly 1,790 published scientific papers, and we'll get into that number, along with some of the world's most trusted metallurgical software programs, got a foundational theory of steel manufacturing completely wrong.
Completely wrong. And to you listening, even if you aren't a metallurgist, even if you've never spent a single second thinking about how a steel beam is forged, this story is going to completely change how you view the digital tools and algorithms you interact with every day.
Oh, absolutely. It's this wild tale of unquestioned assumptions, thermodynamic rule breaking, and really the danger of outsourcing our critical thinking to a computer.
Yeah, so to understand this massive error in modern software, we actually need to rewind all the way back to the 19th century and look at the so-called law this whole house of cards is built upon.
Right. So we are talking about Adolf Fick and his first law of diffusion, which was published back in 1855. And the funny thing here is Fick was working in the anatomy department at the University of Zurich.
Yeah, an anatomy department. He wasn't looking at metal at all.
Not at all. He was running experiments observing the mixing of salty water and pure water.
Right. And Fick came up with a conclusion that feels, honestly, incredibly intuitive to anyone who has ever, say, stirred sugar into tea. He stated that the rate at which those two liquids mix, so the diffusion flux, is directly proportional to the concentration gradient.
Meaning, the bigger the difference in saltiness between the two waters, the faster the salt will diffuse from the highly concentrated area to the less concentrated area.
Exactly. And it fit perfectly into the scientific zeitgeist of the 19th century. Early scientists were just, like, fascinated by simple linear relationships. You push something harder, it moves faster.
Right, because in 1822, Fourier proposed his law of heat, saying heat flow is proportional to the temperature gradient. And then in 1827, Ohm did the same exact thing for electricity.
You could even trace this back to Isaac Newton in 1701 with his law of cooling.
Which, fun fact from the sources on that, by the way, Newton wrote his paper in Latin, but the word he used for thermometer, thermometron, is exactly the same in Latin as it is in modern English.
I love that detail.
Yeah, it's great. But okay, let's unpack this Fick's law thing for a second, because something is really bothering me about it.
What's that?
Well, if a concentration gradient is all it takes to drive diffusion, like Fick said, why doesn't a floating chunk of pure glacier ice soak up all the salt from the surrounding ocean water?
Ah, right.
Like, think about it. The concentration difference between salty seawater and a pure iceberg is massive. If Fick's law is the ultimate truth of how matter moves, that iceberg should be getting incredibly salty.
And that right there is the exact paradox that exposes the fatal flaw in applying Fick's law as a universal truth.
So what's actually happening?
Well, what's fascinating here is what fundamentally motivates an atom to move. Fick assumed it was concentration, but the physics actually tell us diffusion is driven by something called chemical potential.
Chemical potential.
Yeah, which is basically a measure of free energy.
So a free energy gradient, not a concentration gradient, but explain that to me like I'm a five-year-old. What does free energy actually mean in the context of the salt and the ice?
Sure. So atoms are fundamentally lazy. They always seek the lowest possible energy state. Think of free energy like water seeking its own level, or, say, a ball wanting to roll to the bottom of a valley.
Okay, atoms are lazy, rolling down a hill. Got it.
Right. So if you look at that iceberg floating in the ocean, the free energy state of a salt molecule dissolving in the liquid seawater is exactly the same as the free energy state of a salt molecule trapped inside the solid ice.
Wait, really? The energy states are the same?
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
They are already in perfect equilibrium. The ball is already at the bottom of the valley. Because there is no difference in free energy, there is zero thermodynamic drive for the salt to move into the ice.
Wow. So the incredibly steep concentration gradient doesn't matter at all.
It doesn't matter one bit. So Fick's law works fine as a rough approximation if you're just, like, dropping dye into a beaker of water. But it's not the fundamental mechanism of reality.
Right. And material scientists eventually recognized this, didn't they? They adjusted their equations by swapping out concentration gradients for chemical potential gradients.
They did, yeah. They added a thermodynamic factor. But this is the big but, the legacy of Fick's linear thinking. This idea that steep gradients equal fast movement, it left a very dangerous seed in the scientific literature.
Which brings us to the real-world manufacturing of steel, because this is where the atoms really refuse to play nice.
Oh, they absolutely rebel.
Yeah, so the sources focus on the growth of a specific crystalline structure called ferrite, which grows inside another structure called austenite steel.
Right. And to understand the conflict here, we really need to picture what is happening inside the solid metal as it cools down.
Okay, paint me a picture.
So austenite is a specific crystal structure of iron that exists at really high temperatures. Its atomic lattice is arranged in a way that creates nice little gaps, and carbon atoms, well, they love to hang out in those gaps.
Just chilling in the pockets.
Exactly. But as the steel cools down, that structure becomes unstable. It wants to transform into ferrite, which is a different crystal structure that is much, much more tightly packed.
So as the ferrite forms, it physically cannot hold as much carbon. It basically has to kick the carbon out.
Precisely. It evicts the carbon.
Mm.
And this steel alloy doesn't just contain iron and carbon. It also contains manganese.
Right. The manganese is key here.
Very key. As the new ferrite phase grows, it pushes a boundary and interface forward through the solid metal. And to maintain what scientists call local equilibrium right at that moving boundary, the atoms need to be thermodynamically stable.
Meaning both the carbon and the manganese need to get out of the way.
Right. They both have to partition out of the growing ferrite and into the surrounding austenite.
But, and this is the wild part, they do not move at the same speed at all. Carbon diffuses 8 orders of magnitude faster than manganese.
8 orders of magnitude.
That is 100 million times faster. I'm just trying to picture this. Imagine a three-legged race where you've tied an Olympic sprinter, which is our carbon to a garden snail, the manganese.
That's a great way to look at it.
And they are bound together by this thermodynamic requirement to maintain local equilibrium at the boundary. How on earth can the snail keep pace to cross the finish line?
Well, in a real physical environment, the snail simply cannot. It's impossible. But in the 1970s, theoreticians were so determined to make their mathematical models of local equilibrium work.
So they basically cheated.
Basically.
Huh.
They invented a theoretical workaround, a mathematical band-aid called the negligible partitioning local equilibrium mode, or NPLE for short.
Okay, so how does this NPLE math actually fix the three-legged race?
So they played a trick with the thermodynamics. To compensate for the snail's agonizingly slow pace, scientists deliberately selected a theoretical tie line in their phase diagrams. And this line dictates a massively steep concentration gradient for the manganese right at the moving boundary.
Oh, because of Fick's law. Even though we know Fick was technically wrong, the math still says that a steeper gradient artificially boosts the calculated flux, right?
You nailed it. That is the core of the illusion. By modeling a microscopically thin, virtually vertical wall of manganese right at the interface, the mathematics suddenly balance out.
So the impossibly steep gradient mathematically forces the manganese to flow faster to keep up with the carbon.
Yes. The theory assumes that almost no manganese actually diffuses deep into the surrounding metal. That's the negligible partitioning part. It just piles up in this insanely sharp spike right at the border.
So the snail gets a mathematical rocket booster.
Exactly. The snail gets a rocket booster.
Wow. I mean, it sounds so elegant on a whiteboard, but here's where it gets really interesting for the software side of things. Today, modern, highly trusted metallurgical software programs, like we're talking tools like Dictra and MatCalc, they run these complex NPLE calculations routinely for the steel industry.
They do all the time.
And the software tells the engineers exactly how wide this steep spike of manganese is. It spits out a diffusion distance of 0.003 nanometers, sometimes even 0.002 nanometers.
Which is, I mean, it's physically absurd.
Right, because 0.03 nanometers is smaller than a single iron atom. How can you possibly have a gradual concentration gradient across a distance where not even a single atom can fit? It's literally impossible.
It is a pure mathematical artifact. The software is blindly balancing an equation without any spatial awareness of the physical universe. It doesn't know what an atom is.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate for a second here. What if atoms actually want to be clustered together like that? Fick's law assumes everything wants to spread out evenly, but don't some elements naturally clump together?
Oh, they absolutely do.
Yeah.
And this brings up a really cool phenomenon called spinodal decomposition.
Spinodal decomposition.
Okay. Yeah. So in certain alloys, like iron-chromium mixtures, atoms actually prefer the company of their own kind. Iron atoms want to stick with iron, chromium with chromium. So they will actually move uphill against the concentration gradient to clump together.
Uphill diffusion. So they are concentrating themselves rather than diluting themselves.
Right. To visualize this, think of the dark ages of the universe shortly after the Big Bang.
The dark ages, all right.
For a long time, matter was just a uniform, evenly distributed soup of particles. There were no stars, no galaxies, just soup.
Just a uniform soup.
But eventually, gravity began to pull matter together, creating dense clusters that ignited into the first stars, leaving empty voids between them. That spontaneous clustering from a uniform state is the perfect analogy for spinodal decomposition.
Okay, so if atoms are perfectly happy to clump together into dense little stars like that, why can't the manganese form that impossibly thin, incredibly dense spike at the boundary of the steel?
Because of the thermodynamic cost of creating boundaries. Scientists like John Hilliard developed equations to explain this, encompassing something called the gradient energy coefficient.
The gradient energy coefficient, what does that mean in practice?
When atoms cluster together, they don't form perfectly sharp, blocky edges. The transition is always a smooth, gradual wave. Basically, nature hates a sharp edge.
Wait, why does nature care if the edge is sharp?
Because forcing a dramatic change in chemical composition over a tiny distance requires forcing dissimilar atoms into highly unnatural, strained configurations.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, imagine stretching tight microscopic rubber bands between atoms of completely different sizes and properties. That physical strain costs energy, a massive amount of free energy.
So the software assumes this infinitesimally thin atom-sized spike of manganese. What is the actual energy cost to build a wall that sharp?
Well, the sources break down the exact math on this. To create a gradient as steep as 0.1 nanometers, which, by the way, is actually three times wider than what the software predicts, it costs hundreds of joules per mole in gradient energy penalty.
Hundreds of joules per mole just to pay the penalty for the sharp edge. And what is the total energy driving this entire phase transformation to begin with?
The total driving force available in the entire system is only about 100 joules per mole.
Wow. So the energy required just to build that impossible microscopic spike is double or triple the energy that exists in the entire system.
Yep. The thermodynamic bank account is completely overdrawn.
The NPLE theory isn't just slightly off. It is physically prohibited from existing.
Exactly. The gradient energy penalty totally prevents the snail from ever getting its rocket booster. It's grounded.
This raises an enormous question for me, though. If the underlying physics of this theory are mathematically bankrupt, how did it become accepted globally? Like the sources mentioned, there are 1,790 published scientific papers utilizing this impossible NPLE concept.
It's a huge number.
How do 1,790 groups of highly educated scientists publish papers validating a literally impossible theory?
The answer lies in how we misuse our most advanced observational tools. Specifically, devices called atom probes.
Okay, I know atom probes are incredible machines. How do they actually work? And I guess, how are they tricking scientists?
So an atom probe works by taking a microscopic, needle-like sample of a material and applying a massive voltage pulse or a laser pulse to it.
Okay.
And this rips atoms off the tip of the needle one by one. Those atoms fly through a vacuum and hit a detector, which records exactly where they landed and how long it took them to get there. By doing this millions of times, the computer reconstructs a 3D map of the material, literally atom by atom.
I mean, that sounds foolproof. Where does it go wrong?
Speed. Modern atom probes can collect data incredibly fast, which scientists love because it saves time and money.
Of course.
But by ripping the atoms off the sample so rapidly, the machine loses spatial resolution along the Z-axis. The depth of the sample, the reconstruction basically gets distorted. It squishes the data.
Wait, if the data is getting squished and blurry, how does a blurry picture prove a theory that requires a mathematically perfect, infinitesimally thin spike? That seems totally contradictory.
If we connect this to human psychology, it makes perfect sense. The blurriness of the fast atom probe doesn't just make the image fuzzy, it introduces bizarre data artifacts.
Artifacts? Like what?
It creates false clustering effects and creates the illusion of uphill diffusion where none exists. For instance, making it look like silicon is diffusing into the ferrite, which thermodynamically cannot happen.
Oh. So researchers look at this messy, artifact-ridden data showing extreme, physically impossible behavior. And because their software already told them to expect extreme, physically impossible behavior, they view it as validation.
Exactly that. It is textbook confirmation bias. They see a jagged, artificial spike of elements caused by poor machine calibration. And they say, look, the extreme concentration gradient predicted by the NPLE theory is real.
They completely trust the output of the black box without questioning the mechanism inside the black box.
Yes.
So what does this all mean for the real world? For the engineers actually designing bridges or car chassis or aerospace components, if we can't trust the Dictra software and we can't trust the conclusions of 1,799 peer-reviewed papers, what is actually happening inside the metal when it cools?
It means we must entirely abandon the comforting illusion of local equilibrium at these low temperatures. The snail simply cannot keep up with the sprinter, and the thermodynamic tie rope snaps. The interface moves without reaching equilibrium.
Okay, so if the boundary isn't in equilibrium, how far does the manganese actually diffuse?
To avoid that massive gradient energy penalty we talked about, the actual diffusion distance must be much wider, at least 10 to 20 nanometers across.
That's way bigger than 0.03.
Right. And because the gradient is wider and less steep, the manganese moves at its natural, slower pace.
Which means the ferrite growth takes more time.
Significantly more time. When local equilibrium breaks down, metallurgists have to stop using perfect thermodynamic models and start using what are called interface response functions.
Interface response functions? What does an interface response function do differently?
Instead of assuming the atoms instantly achieve a perfect energy balance, an interface response function calculates the actual physical drag.
Like friction?
Yeah. It accounts for the friction of atoms moving across the boundary, the finite mobility of the elements, and the energy dissipated by the moving interface itself. It models the messiness of reality rather than the perfection of a mathematical ideal.
And what does that reveal?
Ultimately, it reveals that the real-world growth of the structure is vastly slower than what the standard algorithms predict.
Which is terrifying if you are an engineer relying on that algorithm. If your software promises you the phase transformation happens in 2 seconds, but physics dictates it actually takes 10 seconds. Your entire manufacturing pipeline, your heat treatment schedules, everything is fundamentally flawed.
It serves as a vital reminder that algorithms do not understand physics. They only understand the assumptions hard-coded into them by human beings decades ago.
That is such a profound takeaway. Let's just step back for a second and look at the whole picture we've painted today. We started in 1855 with a scientist looking at salty water, giving us Fick's law, a rule that was beautifully simple but deeply flawed because it ignored the lazy nature of atoms seeking free energy.
Right.
We then watched the steel industry take that flaw and magnify it, inventing the NPLE mathematical trick to force a slow element to keep up with a fast one.
A mathematical trick that predicted concentration spikes smaller than a single atom.
And despite the massive gradient energy penalty making such a spike thermodynamically impossible, 1,790 scientific papers were published validating it, all because researchers were fooled by blurry artifacts from incredibly fast atom probes. The sheer scale of this blind spot is mind-boggling.
It really is.
And it's why you, the listener, should care about this regardless of your profession. Whether you're using software to mix alloys, employing high-frequency trading algorithms in finance, or asking an AI to solve a logistical problem, algorithms will cheerfully calculate absolute impossibilities if we fail to apply human intuition and check the foundational reality.
A computer feels no hesitation in calculating a 0.03 nanometer boundary. It cannot zoom out and say, wait, this is smaller than an atom. That requires human critical thought.
Absolutely. Now, before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final mind-bending concept from the Vedatio sources that we haven't even touched on yet. And I think it perfectly captures just how weird, rebellious, and interconnected the physical world is compared to our simple A to B equations.
Oh, I know what you're bringing up. Irreversible thermodynamics and cross coefficients.
I am, because laws like Fick's and Ohm's assume a beautifully isolated universe where one force creates one direct flux. A temperature gradient purely causes heat flow. A voltage gradient purely causes electrical flow.
But the real world is messy.
Exactly. Forces and fluxes interact in completely bizarre, unintuitive ways. The source material outlines this amazing, slightly dangerous home experiment. So, listener, if you try this, please use caution.
Oven mitts are strictly required.
Yes. If you take a hot ceramic dish out of the oven, holding it by one end with an oven mitt, and you run the other end of the dish under a stream of cold tap water, the end you are holding in your hand will actually get hotter.
Which completely shatters our basic intuition.
Completely.
You are actively cooling one side of the ceramic, so common sense dictates the heat should flow away from your hand and towards the cold water. But instead, the universe rebels. A force applied in one area, the rest of cooling, creates a reverse flux. An unexpected heating effect somewhere else entirely.
I love that so much. It proves that you can't just isolate one variable and expect nature to politely comply with a linear equation on a whiteboard. The physical world is vastly more complex than the software models we try to cage it in. So think about that hot ceramic dish the next time a piece of software gives you an answer that looks just a little too perfect or a little too simple. Let that idea simmer until our next deep dive. Remember, just because a multi-million-dollar machine prints out a perfectly straight line, it doesn't mean the machine itself isn't broken.